a question. So we could have one question if you like.
I suppose I do.
Yep.
Of the 12 links, it seems like the only place that you can actually sever the links is at ignorance. Is that really the only place that it can be done?
Okay. Yeah, you have to go. Yeah, you have to. Ignorance is the root of cyclic existence. So, see, like later on in the 12 links, so you have ignorance. Then the there's so many different translations. Like let's call it karmic formations or what was said before. Anyway, you know it. Compositional action, and then consciousness, and then there is so name and form and so forth. So then we have a craving, grasping, becoming, or existence. See, when you roll it up from the back. It's very good to meditate on the 12 links on the basis of the Four Noble Truths. And so if you roll it up from the back, so at the end one has sickness and aging and death. But so aging and death is just symbolic, actually, for the Noble Truth of suffering. So it says aging and death, but actually what is meant is any type of suffering. So then that's what we mentioned at the beginning. So despite one's wish for happiness and a lack of suffering, so one always finds oneself in a situation where one is, where, for example, one encounters suffering even though one doesn't wish for it. So why is that? So then in relation to the 12 dependent links, why? Because, one took birth under the control of karma and afflictions, the previous link. So why did one take birth under the control of karma and afflictions? Because before that, at the end of the previous life, there was the ripened karma, so the dependent link of existence. How did the karma get ripened is because of grasping. How did grasping come about is because of craving. So the grasping is just an accelerated form of craving. So how did the craving come about is because of ignorance. So also there, even though it is in the middle of the 12 links, also there, why does the craving come about is because of ignorance. So first of all, the karma is created because of ignorance, but then also later on, the karma is ripened because of ignorance. So no matter how one turns it, one has to eliminate ignorance. So if we want to avoid the craving, we need to avoid ignorance. That is also an important point because so what do we crave? We crave happiness and we crave the absence of suffering. And then we have an experience. So then the mind labels that experience happiness. Or the mind labels that experience suffering. And then in dependence on how it is labeled, it appears to us as the one or the other. And then then the craving comes from that. So also here ignorance is the underlying cause because we believe in a truly existent happiness. So, and also here one can, make it work for oneself. So if we think on, so not the big, how to say, so we said the first link is ignorance. The second link is karma. But you see, there's something missing. It's not explicitly mentioned, so that's why one has to know that. You know, how does one come to karma is because there has to be some action that arises out of ignorance. And so a lot of the time, the action is, out of attachment or anger. And so, you know, both attachment is actually very suitable also to apply this principle. You know, how does it appear when the object is not analyzed, and then how is the, you know, how does it appear when the object is analyzed? So the attachment, when we also analyze attachment itself, it becomes like the, how to say, the, you know, the irrationality of the deluded mind can become very obvious. So, for example, you know, one day, so this is again, it's not really so, you know, such a deep philosophy. So, like one meets one person. So usually at the outset, our mind is neutral. We have no concept of that person as a friend or as an enemy. It's a stranger whom we meet. And then, you know, the person, so they do something. So there's some interaction happens. So if we like that interaction, so then we label that person friend, you know, and we... No, we combine, we associate happiness with that person. So if we don't like that interaction, then we may not label that person explicitly enemy, but we put that person into the camp of people that we dislike. And we then tend to associate suffering with that person. So then in that moment when that happens, so it will appear, you know, it will appear incredibly concrete. So we have formed a picture of the other person, and it will appear as incredibly concrete. And then, so then, you know, what seems to be a common what seems to be a common experience is that, let's say, one has labeled that person a friend. So then automatically, you know, because of the predisposition for most people, automatically then attachment starts to kick in. So one wants to be close to the to that person. Yeah. So then it may happen, you know, one spends the night with that person. So then, no, I don't have that experience myself, but I have been told. So what happens is sometimes what seems to happen is that, you know, for no particular reason, you know, a change in the mind happens. So the evening before, no one did not want to be separated from that person. So then the morning after, no one cannot wait to be separated from the person. So if we just take it without analyzing it, you know, in each given moment, it seems quite rational. Yeah, it seems quite logical because the mind, there's some justification. So it seems quite rational. But then if we start to think about it, you know, does it really, you know, really, really make a lot of sense? So one day, you know, 12 hours before the person is so wonderful, so that we cannot be separated from them, then 12 hours later, know, they're so annoying, you know, that we can't stand to be close to them. So here, so that's also what I meant maybe with making emptiness, making the concept of emptiness, work for oneself. So here, so of course, you know, one can go through one's life, you know, like that. So usually, you know, usually the common experience is that the mind becomes very confused. Because in each given moment it seems very rational, but overall, you know, if we start to think about it, you know, it's a very, very confused state of mind. So here, you know, one can bring some balance, you know, to the mind, you know, by questioning one's appearances. So when one thinks, oh, the person is so super duper wonderful, you know, is that really, you know, how likely is that really to be the case? And then, you know, if we think, oh, that person, you know, is super duper annoying, you know, just 12 hours later, well, you know, how likely is that really to be the case? You know, or is it not more likely it's just an appearance to one's own mind, like a perception to one's own mind, you know, that is also likely to pass again. So same is similar with anger. So usually attachment is generated because the object appears very desirable. So we don't generate attachment for an object that does not appear desirable. And anger is generated for the object that appears the opposite. So when we generate anger towards a person, that person, it appears to us faulty, flawed, harmful to us, and in the worst case, completely dark. So, you know, with anger for one person, we cannot see even one quality. So like this, our mind is always sort of, you know, thrown here and there through the force of the appearances. And the mind always believes, if the mind is not trained, so if somebody lacks spiritual training or mental training, then the mind always believes, you know, in the appearance at the given moment. So there is not this two-step that one can say, oh, hold on, there could be a difference between the time of not analyzing and the time of analyzing. So, for example, when we get angry, how likely is it really that that person has no qualities? So that is not likely. So most of the time, most of our anger is usually directed at people that we are close to, so like our friends, family members, and the like. So they are usually people, from whom we have already received a lot of kindness. But then in the moment of anger, so that, that is completely how is that in English? You blend it out, is that English or German? I can't remember. Blanket, no, like a blending. Anyway, no, it doesn't, it's this quality of the mind, that the mind, sometimes it gets fixated on like just a default. And then also, usually what happens is the mind goes over defaults, you know, time and again. So we, you know, we start to think of all the faults, like all the things that person, you know, has ever done or wrong to us. And then, so that type of analysis, so that's also a form of analysis. You know, it's a, maybe a mistaken analysis. Analysis doesn't always have to be correct. So then that type of analytical meditation, it, you know, it increases the anger. So the, you know, the person becomes, appears darker and darker to our mind. And in the end, like in the end, the person appears as the source of all our problems and sufferings. Even though that person may actually be our mother. So, so here, you know, it gives more freedom to the mind. It gives a freedom to the mind when we know that not all the time, it doesn't always have to be the way it appears to our mind in that moment. So, and also the analysis, so the analysis, we should not confuse the analysis with with make-believe. Yeah, so it is really, I mean, there is that aspect of just directing the mind somewhere else, which brings relief to the mind. But also, you know, the analysis is really also about understanding the reality. Oh, no. Like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, he once said, so he gave this example, you know, of a deluded person perceiving a hook in the wall. And then perceiving the hook in the wall, you know, tries to hang the, you know, the shirt or the clothes onto the hook. And then simply, so trying it, but because the hook is actually not there in reality, so it falls down. You know, trying to hang it there, and then sort of, you know, looking so like in disbelief, you know, cannot understand why does it fall down. And, you know, not because it sees it, the hook is so clear to the mind, it sees it so clearly, so cannot believe. So again, picks it up again, it tries to hang it there again. Again, no, again it falls down. And again, looking in disbelief. So, so this process, you know, it will only be stopped when the person actually tries to check. So there's the appearance of the hook, but we try to check, you know, is the hook really there or not? And then only by understanding that the hook is not there, then, you know, the person can stop the mistaken action. So in Buddhism, there is a lot of talk about. See, there's a lot of talk about what one is not, what one is not supposed to do. And so that can create a complication for the mind. Because, and that is completely understandable. You know, because we cannot, it is not possible, you know, to just take away from the mind, you know, those things that the mind believes will make it happy, and not offering an alternative. So, you know, one cannot just take away from the mind and not offer something in return. So, you know, if we only take away, then the mind will become upset. No, quite rightly, quite rightly so. So we need to, when we practice Buddhism, it needs to be on the basis of analysis. In the traditional instructions, one talks about the three step of listening, contemplating, and meditating. So the contemplating part, that is the part where we compare what we hear so with our personal experience. And that does not always, it doesn't mean that it is always a deep philosophy. It just means actually that we start to think about things. So what is, what is one's own reality? If one's own reality is life is completely perfect, then that is fine. There is no problem there. So how to say this? If one finds, if we find, it is not perfect. So then we need to analyze that. So, for example, everybody wants happiness. So everybody wants to have a good life, a good quality of life. So then we have to think about, how does that good quality of life come about? What are the causes and conditions? Or even we don't even have to. If we don't want to think about it, we don't have to think about it. The reality for the people who don't think about it, the reality is that the mind, becomes, quite crazy, usually to the point of, self destruction. Because that is the thing with dependent arising. There are these, what in Buddhism, in Western terms, one can call it maybe the harmful emotions or harmful mental states, disturbing thoughts, so whatever. But here the thing with these mental states is it's not up to our choice, whether they will make us happy or not. It's simply cause and effect. So the more, for example, the more anger a person has, the less happiness that person will have. So it's not up to choice. It's not wishful thinking. So it's also not up to, somebody deciding. So there's not somebody, with a vicious mind thinking, oh, okay, I decide people who have lots of anger, I decide they are going to be unhappy. So it's not like that. So in Buddhism, it's cause and effect. So when we feel, unhappy inside, the Buddhist thesis is, where does it come from? The Buddhist assertion is, where does it come from? It comes from the mental afflictions. So anger, attachment, ignorance. And we can also throw the self-cherishing into the pot. It's not up to choice. For example, in the Western world. So in the Western world, a lot of the focus is on the external. So one needs to be very careful here. Will I be more happy if I have an iPhone? No. How much extra happiness is the iPad going to give me? I do feel a little bit more happy since I have an Apple computer. No, but we only need to follow the news for some time. So, for example, in what was in Germany. So in Germany, they had this phenomenon, you know, 2 years ago, and it's still going on. So in Germany, you know, soccer is very strong. I think in like maybe baseball in America or basketball. So in Germany, or American football. So in Germany, it is soccer. So there are some, of course, similar. So there are some soccer players, you know, they're very successful. They're very famous. They make, you know, many, many millions of dollars. So there has been this case where this soccer player, you know, completely out of the blue, you know, he committed suicide. And then later it became, of course, then people started to analyze. And then later it became more and more obvious, well, you know, he was suffering from extreme depression for a long time. So this is not philosophy, so that's a reality. You know, it's not deep philosophy. He has a lot of money. He had a nice wife. Well, I don't know her personally, so I don't know if she was nice. But you know, according to conventional, one would say, oh, she looks nice. So, you know, and also nice children. So if one would see them on a picture, one would think, oh, nice family. So then also he had fame, obviously. And then also what I also feel is important is, you know, what also in Western education sometimes there are lots of values placed on that. So he was able to transform, you know, what is his passion, football, into his job and be successful at it. So his life, you know, it had all these ingredients. So that is reality, you know. Yet there was something in his mind, so something was missing. If you would have asked him, how are you? You know, he would have said, I'm fine, out of politeness. But in the mind, you know, he would not have felt fine. Well, there are other people, you know, whose life is not so great. You know, there are other people that may have, you know, very heavy sicknesses. But, you know, because they have this quality that is called mental happiness, so they are really, when they are asked, so how are you? So they will really think, oh, I am fine. It will be their experience. So that's why. So when we, you know, when we start to practice Buddhism, so it is. I think it is very important. You know, and especially so. Not it's important not to get caught up. Not too much only on the side of, so one is not allowed to do this, one is not allowed to do that, and, you know, attachment will not make you happy, and so, you know, then a very sort of gray picture is being painted. So it is very important not to get caught up in that, you know, too much, but also to focus, you know, also on what is actually needed. So we need to offer the mind the alternative. So the alternative is mental happiness. So we need to think about, so what is really, you know, mental happiness? How is mental happiness generated? So now in the Buddhist scriptures, there are so many quotes where it says that the Buddhist path is a path that leads also from happiness to happiness. So if the final result is going to be happiness, so and with enlightenment, you know, we do associate some type of perfect happiness. So that is not going to happen overnight. It's not like, so the Buddhist path is not like, oh, you know, suffering, you know, more suffering, compounded suffering, you know, suffering, the changeable suffering, and then the three sufferings, the six sufferings, the eight sufferings, and then all at once, and then they're all gone, and then there's perfect happiness. So it's not like that. So the way to enlightenment, you know, that starts, you know, when one starts to actually meditate on mental happiness. So that's, you know, so when we need to start with that. So then the mental happiness, so it gets, you know, through the Buddhist path, so then it gets increased, you know, over time. And then sometime it becomes the perfect, you know, uncontaminated happiness of enlightenment. But it is not like going from completely dark to completely light. It's not like that. So it's good to focus on the developing side. And automatically, you know, see, automatically, so the trick is if we develop inner happiness, so then automatically the person feels happy. So there's not really then the need for some extra method. And then, you know, if the person is mentally happy, then many things fall away automatically. So that is also, I think, an experience of practitioners. So if the mental happiness is developed, a lot of the neurotic mind, neurotic thinking, also, you know, anger, you know, unreasonable, like how you say, like just so adventitious types of anger that arise all the time, or that are present, you know, some kind of dissatisfaction. So that can fall away automatically. So through the development of mental happiness. In the meditation on patience, so the very first step that Shantideva prescribes is the meditation on mental happiness. And then, of course, the question arises, how do you develop mental happiness? And that's why you have to come back tomorrow. So mental happiness has to do with cause and effect too. So the second of the 12 dependent links. Mental happiness usually, so it has to do with the right mental action. So if we reduce the self-cherishing thought, then proportionally to that, then the mind is more happy. So that is usually a common experience. So there's nothing wrong, there's nothing wrong with wanting to become happy. And as His Holiness the Dalai Lama, it's almost like a mantra that His Holiness often gives is, so if you want to be selfish, then be wisely selfish and practice compassion. So that so the wish of wanting to be happy, that is not necessarily wrong. But if the emphasis is too much on oneself, so to the exclusion of others, so then that's where it becomes unhealthy for the mind. And that's again, it is a dependent arising. So one just needs to. One just needs to, observe one's own mind in different situations. So it is also very good. It is also very good, actually, to meditate on rejoicing. So in Buddhism, the meditation on rejoicing is seen as very important. And so there's a rejoicing in the qualities of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that may be for a beginner a little bit abstract, but is also important. Then there is the rejoicing in the good qualities of others. And then there's also the rejoicing in one's own qualities. So that is also very important. So I think I think it should be almost a requirement at least once a day to remember so one's own qualities. So it's like one has to find at least one quality that one has. For example, in the evening or sometimes, doesn't need to be all the time, just when one has time, so one can do a kind of review. It could be a review of one's life, it could be a review of the day or the week, how one feels, that it's conducive to the mind. And so actually recall like all the positive actions that one has ever done. One does this. So one should one should do it for so long until naturally in the mind the thought is generated, I'm good. My life is great. And then automatically when that happens, then everything is good. So I'm just saying this because in Buddhism, there's always a lot of emphasis on the things that one is not supposed to do, and this is a meditation that the Bodhisattvas do. So it is. If it's good for Bodhisattvas, it's also good for us. Yeah. And then, like my teacher said, one can do this meditation. For example, for some of you who know more about the Dharma, one can do it also in the context of the precious human rebirth. For example, one may come to discover that one has actually had an incredible life. So one moment one thinks the life is really bad, And then after the meditation, one comes to realize that one has had actually an incredible life, however that may be. So, you know, by thinking about one's qualities, so, and it's good, you know, one should know that one has qualities. So one should be able to say, yes, no, I have these or these qualities. So then the mind goes up, you know. So then when the mind goes too up, too far up, so then we have to bring ourselves down again with the meditations on suffering. It's like that. So like that one can be one's own psychologist. So when the mind is down, one has to build the mind up. And then when the mind is, you know, too far up, one becomes conceited or reckless or proud. And then we have to bring the mind down like that. Anyway, so that is one good method also for generating mental happiness. And then that leaves also very good karmic imprints on the mind, which is then the third of the 12 dependent links. But overall, I don't know, one student asked my teacher, how does one generate inner happiness? And so my teacher said, you have to check up. Like, because the student said, from the morning time when I get up in the morning, then somehow the mind becomes unhappy. And then, so my teacher said, you have to check up what is it in the mind that causes that unhappiness? So here one needs to be a little bit discerning. Because one may think, then a very common, that is not necessarily an uncommon investigation. But then a very common conclusion is, one comes to the conclusion, I'm unhappy because, and then usually it is some fault outside. So I am unhappy because I don't have an iPhone. Or, I'm unhappy because I'm together with that person. I'm unhappy because my mother didn't treat me, perfectly. Like that. So then that would be arriving not at the real reasons, the actual reasons. So the real reasons is the presence of the mental afflictions. So that's in Buddhism, it's always narrowed down. Attachment, kasa, attachment, anger, and ignorance. So with anger, usually one can see, how it would make one unhappy. Attachment, that is a little bit harder to see, because attachment appears as a very good friend. But even there, it's just go by one's own experience, and it can take really a long time to really see, attachment causes suffering. But I don't know, like a good friend of mine, so she once described sort of like the, you know, these phases in her life. So she said, well, you know, she doesn't, when she doesn't have a partner, so then there comes this, so she really wants to have a partner. So it's like, you know, I cannot be without a partner. So she really looks for, you know, for a partner. Then she says, so then she has the partner, but then it becomes suffering. So she says, so then actually, you know, sometimes it happens just through changes in external situations. So the relationship comes to an end. And she says, so actually, you know, if she is honest, the first immediate reaction is relief. You know, she's happy. So, you know, she can actually, so she has this moment, you know, where she can actually see, or, you know, without the attachment, she feels actually better. But then later, you know, through the habit, again, you know, attachment sets in. And again, then there's the feeling, you know, something is missing in the, in life. I mean, there's the, you know, I mean, in Buddhism, you know, maybe one can distinguish between the, you know, like between the attachment that, you know, is sort of normal for a person to have. But then there, you know, sometimes also one can see, or the mind is overcome by too much attachment. So it becomes, you know, the mind becomes too restless, you know, too unhappy, and it becomes destructive. So anyway, try to check. So how does the mind feel? You know, and so the Buddhist assertion is, so if the mind with less anger, lesser attachment, and less ignorance, so that is automatically a happier mind. So one doesn't need to do, if one can achieve that, then one doesn't need to do anything extra. You know, the mind would be perfectly happy. How can one achieve that is by generating the opposite. So that is also very important, I feel. You know, so how, you know, how does one counteract the anger is by generating more love and compassion. And so the trick is, if we have more love and compassion, automatically the mind will be less angry. There will be automatically less anger. You know, the stronger our love and compassion, automatically one has less anger, and automatically the mind will be more happy. So if we work at generating more wisdom by thinking about, you know, dependent arising, and if we work at you know, having less anger by generating more love and compassion, and also generating more patience. And by, you know, patience, the one main aspect, so that's it is really, you know, one really can't emphasize it enough, is that really the essential aspect of the practice of patience is to have a happy mind. You know, that is really, when we want to meditate on patience, that is seen as the, you know, the most important preliminary. Because the angry mind, the unhappy mind, that is the food for anger. You know, it gives nourishment to anger. So that is very convenient. You know, it is very good. It is very appealing to the mind when we think, okay, you know, I want to reduce my anger. So what is that? The method is generate more patience. Yes. So what, you know, what is, how do I really meditate on patience? Well, one of the main aspects of patience is to meditate on inner happiness. So then, in that way, it becomes appealing to the mind. it becomes comfortable. And then also with attachment, we can try, well, if we reduce our attachment, so somewhat, so will it make the mind more happy? What is the difference? One could experiment. For example, some people, they like shopping. Do you like shopping? Do you sometimes buy things that you don't use? So that's very weird, isn't it? So there's something in the mind. You sort of think, I need that, so I just buy it. But then later you don't use it. Sometimes you already know when you buy it, you know you're not going to use it. You just buy it to buy it. So what is that about? What is that about? And it's just to think about. One can just think about, see, in the moment, in the given moment, it seems reasonable. And I don't want to take away that pleasure from you. I don't want to take away that reasonableness. But also, if you think about it, well, how many things have I bought already? So is it really that efficient? And then maybe remember in Buddhism it actually says that underlying dissatisfaction, that one feels, or maybe that sadness or unhappiness that one is trying to counteract, well, in Buddhism it actually says, well, that actually comes because of having attachment. So one could maybe experiment, how does it feel to have less attachment? How would it feel? So instead of buying it, how does it feel not to buy it? So you can make an experiment. So you go into the shop, and the successful visit to the shop is to not have bought anything. And then check, does it make a difference to your happiness? Will you necessarily feel more unhappy just because you haven't bought it? Because also a lot of the, maybe it's time, maybe it's already getting late, is it? Yeah. So should we have some, in case there's some question, maybe a little bit of time? Okay. So there was a lot of my blah blah. I thank you very much for giving me the opportunity. So without you, I couldn't talk about the Dharma. I could only talk to myself. That gets very complicated because I contradict myself. So if you like, we could have a little bit of time for some question or discussion. If you don't have any questions or any points, then we can finish. Yes? Not everything turns to dust. So did everybody understand the question or no? So if I, you know, correct me if I don't sum it up correctly, but so it turns around the meaning of life. No, so the question was, so what is the point of anything if we, in the end, we are all going to die? Is that sort of... Yes, but death is actually, so that is that is very important for one's understanding, and that is actually a very important point, you know, because the meditation on death and impermanence is very strongly emphasized in Buddhism, and also of course in other spiritual traditions. But in Buddhism, death and impermanence is emphasized very greatly. That becomes very obvious after having gone to a few Buddhist talks. So here it is very important, to approach this with the right understanding, that when in Buddhism, when it talks about death, death is when the mind has left the body. So the body may turn to dust, but not the mind. So just because there is death, that doesn't mean that everything stops. So that's, that's the thing about death. So once the person has died, then, so that particular person, so then, they have gone, so that's true. But that doesn't mean just because we die, that does not mean that what we do is meaningless. So what we do in this life, that determines our next life. So for example, what we do today, that determines how we feel tomorrow. Similarly, what we did yesterday, that will determine how we feel today. How we have lived the last month, that will determine how we sort of will feel the next month. And so similarly, what we do in this life, it doesn't just dissipate, but it will determine how our next life looks like. So that's with the link of consciousness. That's the idea of the link of consciousness, that what we do, our actions, so they are stored on the consciousness. And so if the right causes and conditions come about, then those karmic imprints, they produce results. It's good to think. I mean, that's but it's good to think. It's very funny. We I don't know if this will be useful for you, but we are really like that. We are being told. So I don't know. Some of you I know have been Buddhism already some years. Some I'm not. I don't know from before, but. In Buddhism, so we're always told, samsara is suffering. You know, the Buddha said, samsara, not nice. No, but so we hear it, but in our mind we sort of think, ah, yeah, yeah. No, isn't it so in our mind? We sort of think, oh, well, you know, how bad can it be? No? Until, you know, something bad happens. And then we sort of there, you know, with wide open eyes, oh, you know, samsara is suffering. So that's true, you know. So the Buddha said, yes. That's a situation like that. So, you know, the Buddha said, so while you're in samsara, we are exposed to, you know, birth, aging, and death, sickness and death. So that's true. So it's part of life, and it happens. Is it pleasant? No. So that's why it's good to get out of it. Yeah, so that is good. That is really for one's understanding. So when we practice Buddhism, you know, it's always good to apply, you know, the right understanding. So in Buddhism, when we think about death and impermanence, we should think about it in the context of past and future lives. So death means that the consciousness has gone on to a future life. If you think about death and impermanence in the context of only one life, then it probably will only make us upset. Now that is a very important point. No, because we are always advised to meditate on death and impermanence. And it is really a very effective meditation, but we need to do it in the right context. So if we view our situation like going from a past life to a future life via this life, then we sort of see ourselves, you know, in this dependent arising, you know, in this context, so then it makes sense and it becomes effective to meditate on death and impermanence. If we don't do that and we meditate on death and impermanence, you know, it can even make the mind so unnecessarily upset, or even give the notion, you know, introduce a nihilistic idea. Of course, that's very true. If I think, you know, if I think there's no past life, if I think there's no future life, and then I think about, you know, death, so no future life and death, then I have to, you know, probably also for me, you know, the conclusion would be, well, you know, then I'm just going to try to have as good a time as possible until that, you know. So, you know, but it is, you know, I would probably quit being a monk. You know, I would but the meditation on death and impermanence is supposed to, you know, turn the mind towards the Dharma, not away from it. So that comes about, you know, if we think about death and impermanence in the context of past and future lives. So that's important. That's important. Okay, so then we can, if you like, we can do a brief dedication. So we can, so now, yeah, so don't worry about that. So So first of all, through discussing the Dharma. So first of all, so that you took the time, you know, out of your busy life tonight for the Dharma. So that is really, that is really something very special. And so you have done also something very special tonight. You know, the karmic, if you would know all the karmic implications, you know, you would feel like you have won in the lottery. But it's good sort of to rejoice. So just for a minute, to think about it, so rejoice, you know, that is really tonight, or tonight I have really done something, you know, to achieve true happiness for myself and also for others. So that is, you know, that's what life is about. So that one can really, you know, rejoice for a minute that one has took the time, you know, came here, then, you know, sitting for 2 hours on the ground, uncomfortable. And then we can think, so this positive potential that we created, you know, through meditation, through discussing the Dharma, through thinking about the Dharma. So through this positive potential, may instantaneously, immediately, all sentient beings have perfect happiness and be free from suffering. So we don't dedicate for ourselves. We dedicate for others. So may I, you know, through this potential, through the power of this positive potential, may instantaneously all war, strife, fighting, anger, etc., immediately be pacified. May immediately be enlightenment generated in the minds of all sentient beings. Sort of like emptying one's bank account. So we don't dedicate for our own enlightenment, but we think by this positive potential, may others, all others, become enlightened. But this was a dedication. It doesn't mean that everybody actually became enlightened. So in order to actually be able to lead others to enlightenment, so I need to become enlightened myself. So may this positive potential that I created tonight become the cause for my enlightenment, which is for the benefit of others, so to lead them, to be able to lead them to that enlightenment that I dedicated for before. Okay, then thank you very much and have a good evening.